It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday, and we'll learn how to bake with honey. But first, this morning's opening bell at the New York Stock Exchange rang in what may become the biggest initial public offering, or IPO, in U.S. history. The Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba's U.S. stock offering opened this morning at $98 a share. That's 38% higher than its original expected price. The company is expected to raise at least $21 billion in this offering, knocking Visa out of the top spot as the biggest U.S. IPO ever. It raises some fundamental questions like who, what, and is this going to affect us down the road? With us now is Chris Farrell. He's economics editor at Marketplace Money and economics correspondent for Marketplace. He's also a contributing economics editor at Business Week magazine. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Well, first, who and what is Alibaba?
So Alibaba is the founder. He founded 15 years ago out of an apartment in China. Is an internet company that creates marketplaces. So it matches buyers and sellers. And the total transactions over its websites last year was, what, about $250 billion. Just to put that in context, for Amazon, it's about $116 billion.
Wow. And so this company, as I understand it, is a little bit Amazon, a little bit eBay, and a whole lot of other stuff, too.
Yes, it is. And I think eBay is the right analogy, because what eBay does is eBay is an auction market, but it's matching buyers and sellers. That's a lot what Alibaba does, because its profit margins, I mean, this is kind of pretty amazing. Its profit margin is about 40%. So it doesn't actually, you know, own the stuff that it's selling, competing in the retail business. It's bringing together the buyers and the sellers and taking a piece of the action. So this reflects the power of the consumer in China and the rise of the consumer in China. And it's also a good business model that I think we're going to be seeing some competition here in the U.S.
And the founder of the company, as you said, he started it in his apartment. He's a former English teacher. He rang the bell on Wall Street. This has been all over the news. Why are we so excited about this initial offering here?
You know, I think this is one of those bright letter days in history that will stand out for a long period of time. So if we're thinking about the digital universe, the digital economy, do you remember it was back in 1995 in August, Netscape. Remember Netscape?
Oh, yeah.
It went public, and the stock went way up. And the thing is, you know, what that signaled, and that was really the beginning of the dot-com boom, what it signaled to corporate America was that there were enormous commercial possibilities in the internet. And it also signaled to every entrepreneur out there that was in the high-tech world that this is where we're going to put our money, this is where we're going to put our brain power. Now you look at what Alibaba has done. It's created enormous wealth in China. It's got 6,000 employees and shareholders. They've got a lot of wealth. And I think this really signals that the entrepreneurial high-tech sector of China is growing rapidly. It has been growing rapidly. It's like a public statement that they're on the world stage. And therefore, this digital economy is going to grow a lot faster from a global perspective. It's going to grow a lot faster. It's going to be a lot deeper and a lot more competitive than it was pre-IPO.
Yeah, you know, you hear the story, they started in a garage or the back room or whatever, and they ended up being billionaires. You could attach a lot of American names to that high-tech story. Are we going to see more and more Chinese names having that story told?
We absolutely are. And the city of Hongshan, which is where Alibaba is based and where it was founded, it's becoming an entrepreneurial hotspot. And there's a university there that is kind of a feeder into all this high-tech entrepreneurialism. And then you have a number of other Chinese companies, you know, that are laying down the gauntlet that, you know, they're going to be going after some of the markets that Cisco's in and that IBM is in. And so I do think this signals the beginning of a new stage of increased competition, sophisticated competition in the high-tech sector, and much more global. And Silicon Valley will remain important, but Silicon Valley over the next 10 years will probably not be as important as it was as their other parts of the economy become like it.
Now, most of us aren't probably buying Alibaba stock today, but is there going to be a time not far down the road when instead of going to Amazon to buy something or to a brick and mortar store or their website or eBay, we're going to be doing something that Alibaba at least partly owns
here in the U.S.? And that seems to be the plan. I mean, that was part of what the money that they're raising with this IPO, initial public offering. And yes, they're very interested in expanding into the U.S. and is going to increase our options. And I think it's really going to provide, if they do move more into the U.S., you know, provide some real options for small entrepreneurs to have a really viable digital presence. They're very strong in Brazil, for example. They have a very big presence in South America. They're coming here, and Amazon's going to have increased competition.
Now, among the many wacky things that makes the economy hard to understand, we've been hearing in the news that
there are quite a few of those.
There's a lot of them. We're hearing Yahoo is making a lot of money because they own a lot of the stock. I know Alibaba, I guess, owns some or all of companies like Lyft, so some things that are more familiar names in the U.S. It's hard to know, just watching from the outside, where one company begins and the other ends, even when we're talking about American and Chinese companies.
Well, that's absolutely right. And that, you know, that really is the story of companies and globalization. Because if you go and you buy a Honda car, you know, most of it is made. In fact, we are now exporting from the Honda plant in Ohio, we're exporting to the rest of the world Honda cars. And if you look at that Honda car and you look underneath the hood, the Honda car is largely made in America, but it's also got parts coming from Germany and parts coming from Japan. I mean, it's a global product, even though it has this label Honda. And you've hit on, I think, a really important thing. I think, you know, people are buying pieces of each other. It's all kind of mixed in together. And, you know, Alibaba has its own payment system, Alipay, just like eBay has PayPal. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be a lot of what is going on, except for what we do know is that as consumers, I think the consumer is a true beneficiary, that this will provide more options and more prospects for some cheaper prices. And from the entrepreneurial point of view, again, I think this just adds to the entrepreneurial prospects from a global perspective.
Okay. You point toward a positive benefit for consumers, more competition, going to drive down prices for us maybe in the short run. Or is this going to be an even bigger fish that drives out the large fish, and ultimately the markets are going to get more concentrated and we're going to have fewer options on buying stuff?
Well, you know, there is in the high-tech markets, there's the sort of first-mover advantage and the network advantage. So if you look at a company like Alibaba, which has grown to be this enormous presence, there have been other internet-based companies in China, but they've gotten so big that now everyone turns to them. And so you do see that effect, and it definitely is something that goes on in the high-tech world. I think you've hit on something extremely important. It's farther down the line. However, it's something that we really do have to keep a close eye on, that even though there are lots of names out there, how much beneath the surface is there consolidation going on, and is there a little bit of monopoly pricing power going on? But I think over the next, 10 years, that's probably not going to be the story, but that is something to really keep an eye on.
I'm going to end with kind of an old-fashioned concept of a national economy. We used to be big manufacturers. We had, a lot of tough competition from China and elsewhere. Information, for a long time, has been our distinctive product here in the United States. Now, there's this big Chinese technology company that's taking that over. Is there anything that we do here in the U.S. that still has a competitive advantage that someone else can't duplicate and do better?
I don't think you can. Once you add in can't duplicate and do better, I don't think so. I think that there's no reason. There's nothing in our DNA here that says that we are going to do it better than other people. What we do have is an edge that we are still open to entrepreneurship. And we are open, we are more open than many societies to allowing for innovation and then figure out how to deal with it later on with the downside. So that is a real strength. And we have an incredible education system, and we have a pretty good feeder system between innovative companies and the education system. But from a global perspective, if we don't improve our overall education system, and if we don't raise the incomes of the bottom half of society, we can no longer rely on just say, well, we're the most innovative, we're the most creative, we'll come up with the new ideas, let other people make it. That no longer is going to work. You're going to have to be, your human capital investments have got to pay off throughout an economy, not just a 10%.
Chris, you always make economics fun and comprehensible. Thank you for joining us again.
Thanks a lot.
That's Chris Farrell. He's Marketplace Money's economics editor, also a contributing economics editor at Business Week magazine. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Late summer and early fall, as I understand it, are prime honey harvesting times. So there's a lot of local product hitting the stores. So it's a good time to talk about cooking and baking with honey. One of WPR's in-house foodies, Lori Skelton, has been experimenting, as always, this time with honey in the kitchen over the last few weeks, and she's here to share what she's learned. Lori, welcome back.
It's good to be here, especially about this topic.
Yeah, so I am always surprised at how much variety there is in the world of honey. I just think honey is a thing like white sugar or something. I am so very wrong.
Which is why I hit the Dane County Farmers Market a couple of weeks ago. I went to three different vendors and bought a jar of what they called wildflower honey.
Mm-hmm.
No difference, no specific flower, just wildflower honey, but it came from three different parts of the state. So just having everybody tasting the honey was three different tastes all together.
And so what kind of varieties did you find and the rest of our coworkers when they tried these three different wildflower honeys from Wisconsin?
Well, to start off with, closest to Madison is Marston's in McFarland, which everybody said classic honey taste. Very sweet, had a butterscotch caramel note to it. This is what I associate honey with. You recognize Dale Marsden when you're on the square in Madison. He's the guy who's wearing the hat that looks like a beehive.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you go to Gentle Breeze in Mount Horeb, and they don't always have wildflower honey. Mm-hmm. When they do, you'll definitely notice it. It's one of the darkest honeys around. This is the one that everybody said reminded them of molasses, of ginger snaps. Somebody said this tasted almost like bourbon. And then from Boscobel, there was from San Cortez and Herbs, they do their wildflower honey with a little bit of the comb still in it, so there was some texture to it. Almost everybody talked about how flowery this one tasted. This one had even more of the outside in the jar than just sweetness. This was really surprising to a lot of people.
So it just depends on what flora is available in the wildflower community for these local bees to get at.
I of course was asking, when you say wildflower, are you talking native plants or are you just talking what happens to be in somebody's back garden? And there's a wide range. I have neighbors on my street who have hives. Mm-hmm. And they actually harvested a little bit of honey in early June. Pale golden color, delicate flavor. And then the honey they were harvesting 2 weeks ago, I mean, if it's based on the 30 flowers I had in my backyard to begin with, we're talking a real hodgepodge here.
All right. Well, I missed a lot of the honey tasting, but you brought one in to try today, and I'm going to give this a shot now.
Now, this isn't local.
It's not local. Oh, this is Italian.
This comes from Tuscany.
Okay.
One of the first times I ever tried cooking with honey in a savory recipe was something that was recommended for Tuscan fennel, and that is chestnut honey from Tuscany. I love this stuff. And if you've got an Italian grocery in your neighborhood, there's a good bet you'll be able to find this. If not, it's easy to order online.
All right, I'm taken aback by what I'm tasting. I mean, it's honey, yeah.
But
there's a lot going on. So, I mean, like, there's so much variety. I mean, people get all, you know, wine expert on it. There's so much variety. Like, is there that level of difference and variation?
Absolutely. And as you're spending more and more time local, sustainable, and more people are starting to look into having hives of their own, it can be as fun as having a craft beer party if everybody shows up with their own jar of honey.
Wow. So honey is sweet.
Honey is
sweet. Newsflash, people. But you mentioned using it in savory dishes. What kind of savory dishes would we put honey in?
Everybody thinks of honey glazed carrots. but it's great on other vegetables as well. Fennel is a great one to start with. If you are a little bit unsure about using fennel, braise it with honey, and it's going to make a real difference to whatever protein you're serving it with. An easy way to get started is to take your protein and just use honey as the glaze to give it some moisture and sweetness. It's marvelous with salmon. It's marvelous with duck. And when I put out the call for give me some suggestions, a friend of mine says she does a version of meatballs that she discovered on the Ivory Coast, where she's got her ground meat mixed with red pepper flakes, garlic, peanuts, carrots, thyme, mint, marjoram, and then when the meatballs come out of the oven, she drizzles them with honey and lemon juice and serves it over rice.
Well, that sounds amazing. And I guess if I think about it, a lot of barbecue sauces have honey in them, so it's not as crazy as I thought it sounded.
Absolutely.
At first.
Oddly enough, one of the interesting things about a sweeter meat like duck or rabbit or a nice hefty salmon, it can sometimes play with additional sweetness without going overboard. And for something like that, this more savory honey, this chestnut honey that has that almost menthol aftertaste, buckwheat is another good one that is a little bit better for savory dishes. You can have a lot of fun experimenting.
And then getting away from the savories, you made some treats to try at WPR, some honey cakes. And by the way, we've got a recipe or two on the Central Time Facebook page. You made a loaf, a honey cake loaf.
Honey cakes are a traditional food served for Rosh Hashanah, which is next week. And I was checking with a lot of friends. Tell me about honey cake, your favorite. Almost everyone said, you know, it's traditional, but they usually turn out dry. They're not always the most pleasant to eat. So my focus was on finding recipes that wouldn't be dry. For the loaf version, I used a solid cup of that molasses-type honey, along with a little bit of spice, and you make it a couple of days ahead of time. Honey has this wonderful property in that it's hygroscopic. It pulls moisture from the air. So if you make it ahead a couple of days, it'll actually get a little less dry.
Weird.
And it was delicious. The texture was moist enough, but it wasn't heavy, but it still had a robustness. Again, I almost want to say it was rustic, especially when you contrast it to what I was absolutely shocked to find from a bunch of Australian Jewish cooks, a chiffon cake made with honey.
All right, tell us about that chiffon cake, yeah.
Now, one of the things you have to watch when you're baking with honey, especially if a recipe doesn't normally call for all of its sweetness, honey is acidic. So you have to add a little bit extra baking soda. You have to do something to leaven it. And this one, it actually called for self-rising flour, and it was half honey and half sugar. But oddly enough, you didn't taste any sugar. This cake, before it was glazed, had the lightest, almost a spongy texture to it, and the honey flavor just lingered in your mouth long after you took a bite. They suggested glazing it with lemon and confectioner's sugar. I actually preferred it without the glaze.
You know, it's interesting talking about baking with honey where the recipe doesn't call for it. I've had things where I think people just substituted honey for sugar, and it was not good.
When you're dealing with a really, really sweet honey, something that doesn't have a lot of complexity to it, it's maybe one specific note, you may want to dial back. Normally, you can substitute honey for sugar up to a cup. Once you get to a cup or more, you'll definitely want to dial it back, probably reduce it by 1/4 cup for every cup of sugar you would normally use. Honey does caramelize faster, so you might also want to turn your oven down about 25 degrees if your recipe doesn't originally call for honey.
And we mentioned a Rosh Hashanah and the traditional honey cake. Is honey a staple ingredient, you know, in Jewish cooking?
Well, when you consider where a lot of Jewish cultures began, especially around the Mediterranean, you know, think about Greek cuisine and Turkish and North African. Wherever you're not going to find cane sugar, you're going to find honey. And there's another Rosh Hashanah tradition in addition to the honey cake. It's dipping apples in honey to wish for a sweet new year. Oddly enough, honey will do for cut apples and pears, the same thing that lemon juice will do. It will prevent them from browning.
Because it's acidic, like you said.
And so if you want to make a fruit salad that holds its color, but you don't want to have the lemon or the lime flavor, go ahead and make a very weak honey water, and that should do it.
Well, that's brilliant. What a great tip to leave us with. Lori, thanks, as always, for joining us.
This was sweet. Lashana Tova.
That was Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house foodies. And again, you can find the honey cake recipes over at the Central Time Facebook page. Make them. Bring them to Vilas Hall. You'll probably want to eat them yourselves. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's been 40 years since a movie character and fictional news anchor took to the airwaves to express his anger, and the sentiment he expressed is one many people relate to still today. Let's take a listen.
So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, "I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!"
That's Howard Beale, the fictional news anchor for the 1976 film Network, a satirical look at media corporations and television news. At the same time, it's been seen as maybe an eerily accurate prediction of what was to come in the decades that followed. Our next guest says that such a movie rarely gets made anymore. One man's vision of the world, independent of studio testing or market research. In a new book, he tells the story of Paddy Chayefsky, the man behind Network, as well as how the movie got made, its lasting impact, and how the movie's vision panned out in the media landscape. Joining us now is Dave Itzkoff. He's a culture reporter at the New York Times, and his new book is Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. Dave, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Let's start with that famous bit from the movie we just played there. If you could count up all the times it's been quoted, misquoted, paraphrased, and parodied, it's probably one of the most influential single lines in movie history. What is it about that that stuck with us and maybe still resonates today?
Sure. Well, you know, I think when the film was released in 1976, I mean, that moment and the language of the speech, all the things that, you know, Howard Beale is sort of rattling off about, you know, the depression and the inflation and the oil crisis. I mean, those were very real issues that the country was going through. And I think there was a lot of repressed frustration going on at the time. And, the speech itself seemed to be saying, well, I mean, if you can't do anything else, at least you can get angry. That's a place to start. And, you know, certainly America has not calmed down very much in those past 40 years. Different issues, but plenty of things to be frustrated about. And so, you know, without maybe looking too deeply at what the speech is really saying, they're easy words to fall back on.
For people not familiar with the movie, let's bring them on board. Can you give us a synopsis of what it's all about?
Sure. So the story of the film is triggered by this television anchor, Howard Beale, who's played by the actor Peter Finch, who is working for a fourth place broadcast network in an era when there were really only three broadcast networks. The anchor is told that he's going to be fired, and so he threatens in the middle of one of his broadcasts to commit suicide on the air in a future show. And this sort of triggers a conflict within the network between its sort of old school news director, played by William Holden, who wants to make sure that Beale doesn't go on the air and continue to rant and rave, and between a sort of new generation of entertainment and programming executives, specified or typified by a character played by Faye Dunaway, who very much wants to keep Beale out there, realizing that the angrier and more insane he gets, the better it is for the ratings of his show and for this declining network.
So Paddy Chayefsky wrote the movie, and it doesn't seem like this happens that often. This is a movie in the writer's voice, right? Usually if you want to be a writer and have the movie be yours and under your control, you have to be writer/director. How did he get this kind of influence over the movie he wrote?
Well, I mean, it was something that he had to build up over a span of, you know, nearly 20 years. People might remember him also as the writer of films like Marty, which,
great movie,
of course, won, you know, the best picture Oscar and best screenwriter Oscar in 1955. But that was more of a kind of a personal drama, a story about, you know, a lonely butcher looking for love in the Bronx. And in the 20 years that followed, I mean, Chayefsky would continue to write those kinds of personal stories, you know, for film and for theater. But I think as his worldview expanded, as he became more aware of what was going on, I mean, he certainly felt a kind of obligation to take on, you know, broader topics in his writing. And certainly, I mean, he was always very concerned in his own career just about protecting his control over his work and his ability to make sure that, you know, what he put down on the page was what got onto the screen. And so, you know, I mean, he fought tooth and nail in a lot of scenarios to, you know, make sure that these, you know, the projects were handled the way he wanted, and would walk away from things if he felt that he couldn't get the autonomy that he felt he deserved. So, you know, by the time 1976 rolls around, he's definitely, you know, accrued a lot of power.
You looked at his notes, Chayefsky's notes in the writing of this movie, and one thing you highlight is the thought, this movie doesn't have a voice or a perspective yet, but the one thing it had going in it was anger. Right. Can you talk about this film as an expression of Paddy Chayefsky's anger?
Sure, sure. I mean, that was a document that he wrote to himself, you know, probably in 1974 or 75 as he's composing the script and kind of getting frustrated with himself. And, you know, I mean, he was such an amazing self-editor. I mean, not the kind of person who really shared a script with, you know, his producing partner or with a studio until he really felt it was done, at which point it was, okay, let's just roll the cameras. I'm not asking for your notes. But, you know, I mean, as I was saying earlier, I mean, there were a lot of things that frustrated him. I mean, in his private life, he certainly had a kind of fractious relationship with both his wife and his son, and kind of escaped into his work. And he was also kind of, you know, very politically attuned, and almost, you know, by the 1970s to a kind of paranoid degree. I mean, not only with what was happening in America, but around the world and in the Middle East. And, you know, so, I mean, all of these concerns and, you know, fears about, you know, corporate influence over media and you know, the ability of, you know, multinationals to buy up these corporations. I mean, all these things are kind of weighing upon him. And you know, he really feels he's got this duty to somehow tell one story that's going to get at every single one of these ideas. And, I mean, it's quite a mammoth task. And yet, you know, he does almost kind of pull it off.
And this network anchor, Howard Beale, was in a way just expressing that same kind of raw anger. And on the other hand, he's a puppet of the corporations that Paddy Chayefsky was upset about. How much of Howard Beale was Paddy Chayefsky?
Well, you know, I think, you know, I mean, not the insane part, let's say. I mean, I think the movie draws a very clear distinction as to when Howard Beale, you know, loses his mind, and that the Mad as Hell speech actually comes after that. And there's as much Chayefsky in Howard Beale as there is in Max Schumacher, you know, the William Holden character, who, you know, as everybody else is running to their window and screaming, you know, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore, you know, there's Holden, you know, kind of sitting there shaking his head in despair and realizing that, you know, some kind of Rubicon has been crossed. And I think Chayefsky is there in that scene, too. I mean, he's seeing the rapid pace of technology, and especially communication technology, and realizing that, you know, the people by and large are not really thinking about, well, you know, how do I get my information and you know, who do I trust to deliver it to me?
And Chayefsky actually created the network, this fictional network, as a character. It had, what, a corporate structure and a full broadcast schedule, right?
That's right. I mean, and these are details that don't even really turn up in the movie. But before, you know, he felt that he could write the script, he felt that he had to kind of fully flesh out this whole operation. So he drew up for himself, you know, these whole, like, organizational charts with, you know, names and titles for, you know, every, you know, high-level employee at the company, and even made up a whole programming grid of what would have been airing on, you know, this fictional UBS channel at, like, every half hour of prime time. And, you know, these are things that, again, they don't, you know, you as viewers would never even see in the movie, but that he felt, you know, he had to have this information at his disposal to create this world.
You quote, I think it was Chayefsky's son, as saying, well, this wasn't really a satire of TV. It was TV here was a metaphor for society and the corporate world. It really seems like it's a satire of TV as you look at it and as you write about how much Chayefsky disliked the television landscape.
Well, I think that was certainly one major concern for him, certainly one very strong motivating factor for him. But I think he did genuinely believe that it was telling a larger story about, you know, corruption and alienation, and that's very present, you know, in the sort of, you know, the love triangle story among Holden and Faye Dunaway and Beatrice Strait, that, you know, Holden, you know, leaving his wife for this programming executive, even as she's trying to, you know, steal away his show, and that, you know, even when Holden dismisses Dunaway at the very end of the movie, when he tells her, you know, you're television incarnate, and, you know, there's a sort of a duality to that speech, that he's using all this language that could certainly apply to a human being, but is also very true of television, and so, you know, it's he's kind of blowing off both the person and the medium.
We're talking with Dave Itzkoff, author of Mad as Hell, about the making of the movie Network and the media future it portrayed. When we come back, we'll talk about whether or not it was prophetic, how much of what was in the movie is just part of everyday life now in the United States. You can join the online conversation on the Central Time Facebook page. Are you a fan of Network? Did it make you think and take a look at the media in a different way? Where do you see the influence of it in today's media, maybe even today's movies? Post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the 1976 movie Network, how it got made, and the media environment it portrayed. Dave Itzkoff is with us talking about his book, Mad as Hell. And we want to hear from you. What do you think of the movie Network? Did it accurately portray the media of the time or the media of our time? Post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to the phones now. We've got Charlie on the line in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I must say, Network is one of my favorite movies of all time. In fact, it came out when I was 7, and I've come to the movie several times and always come away at how fresh it is. I mean, from what was once Saudi Arabia could be Japan of the 90s, and which could be China today. The feminism issues that are brought up by Faye Dunaway are still as talked about now as they were back then, and the news media is totally entertainment. And you see that now, as it was becoming in the movie. I was just going to ask our guest, how did Patty think of? Did he intend it to be as timeliness a movie as it is? Because it's just fascinating, even the terrorism issues.
Charlie, thanks for the call. Dave, how did it stay so timely, he wonders.
Yeah, you know, I think you know, Chayefsky would probably give you a different answer depending upon, you know, what day of the week and what time of day you asked him. I think on some days, you know, he did see this as, you know, a very direct sort of comment on what he thought was going to happen to the media if people weren't more careful, that was sort of the intent of the film. And on other days, he might tell you, no, it was I was aiming for something bigger and broader, and it's not just about television. But, you know, I at the risk of, you know, oversimplifying, I mean, I think, you know, he was just, you know, I mean, he was somebody who wasn't necessarily inclined to see the upside or the, you know, the better side of humanity, that it wasn't hard for him to look at what was going on in his present day and just sort of, you know, to see it through a somewhat pessimistic lens or, you know, a skeptical lens and just extrapolate a little bit that, you know, if we didn't, you know, if we didn't, you know, treat the subject of news with a kind of, you know, dignity, that this is what was going to happen.
Charlie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dave, in your book, you write that Network, quoting here, provided a roadmap for the unraveling of the monolithic broadcasting companies, the diminishment of their once mighty news operations, and a path to a fragmented and unrecognizable media environment that the industry would follow almost to the letter over the next 40 years. Talk about how that has played out since the making of Network almost 40 years ago.
Sure. And, I mean, again, remember that this is all happening in a three-network landscape before, you know, cable TV or the Internet even exists. But, you know, the central conflict that Chayefsky is envisioning between, let's say, the Holden and Dunaway characters is one between, you know, the news operation and the entertainment operation of a network. And that's exactly what happens by the 1980s, that the larger corporations that own these networks and the networks themselves are looking at the bottom lines. They're saying that, you know, news itself can't be a loss leader anymore. It can't, you know, just provide this public service and continue to lose money for, you know, for their parent companies. And so at that point, you know, news itself has to become profitable, and that's when it becomes entertainment. And that's exactly what what transpires. Of course, another big factor is, you know, the FCC relaxing its own equal time rules, and then that allows all kinds of, opinion and, to enter into, the presentation of news. And that's when you get all these sort of latter-day Howard Beale-like figures on the airwaves.
We'll go to back to our phones now. We've got Tim on the line in Wisconsin Dells. Tim, hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I'd like to mention that a relative of mine and his daughter were in that movie. And they played a part where the daughter asked the father if he thought they would really do it. And he says, go over to the window, open up the window, and listen. And that was my cousin Cindy. And she stuck her head out the window, and everyone's yelling, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it. And also, my uncle played the part when Howard Beale had his heart attack. My uncle came out, and he was the replacement newscaster. My uncle
no
name
kidding.
Was Stanley Grover.
Did he play the character named Jack Snowden? Was that his character?
It's been so long since the movie that I can't really remember. But he was the replacement newscaster. He was also in Independence Day, and he had a very tiny part in Dances with Wolves.
All right, Tim, thank you for bringing that up. And that reminds me, another prominent relative in that film, Walter Cronkite's daughter.
That's right. If people remember the film this well, there's a group of left-wing radical terrorists. One of the constituents is a woman named Mary Ann Gifford. She's supposed to be a sort of a play on Patty Hearst, and she was played by a young actress named Kathy Cronkite, who was indeed the daughter of Walter Cronkite. Walter Cronkite was a good friend of the network director, Sidney Lumet, and, may have put in a good word for his daughter, may have helped her get hired there. It's also likely the filmmakers thought that was going to maybe inoculate them from some criticism, or at least, you know, the TV industry would think, hey, you know, they're in on the joke if, Cronkite's own daughter can participate in the film.
And Patty Chayefsky wrote an apology, right, to Walter Cronkite after the movie came out, or at least something saying, hey, this isn't about you?
Well, exactly. That, you know, in the run-up to the film, there was a tremendous pushback, from the TV news industry, that people were really kind of horrified by the film and offended by some of the ideas that it presented. And, you know, Cronkite was quoted in several of these news articles. And, you know, Chayefsky, who did not really easily apologize for anything, suddenly realizes that, you know, maybe he has gone too far, or at least, you know, hurt the feelings of, you know, thoughtful people whose, you know, help he needed to gain access to, you know, research his movie. And so, you know, he writes to Cronkite and also to John Chancellor just to say, hey, you know, I never meant this movie as an attack on you or your business.
Back to our callers now. We've got Lynn on the line in Eau Claire. Lynn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. Good afternoon. This media, it seems, now is open to the highest bidder. All forms, print, the news, television and radio. I know in the 40s and 50s during the Cold War and early 60s during the Cold War era that Hollywood kind of pretty much pandered to the right, and it seems we're doing the same thing again. And one of the epithets that we use here in my home is, well, you must get your news from Fox.
Lynn, thanks for the call. Do you think, I mean, Patty Chayefsky passed away in the early 80s, I think it was. Would he agree with Lynn?
Well, you know, I think he would certainly agree with the assessment that, you know, I mean, that media definitely, you know, it towed a certain line, you know, in the post-World War II era. And, you know, I mean, it was fortunate there was a sort of great flourishing of, you know, mainstream filmmaking that, you know, was willing to tackle some very tough issues, some very controversial issues, you know, Network being just one of several films the same year, you know, All the President's Men came out and Marathon Man. I mean, very kind of, you know, suspicious and paranoid films. The news environment that followed, I think, would almost certainly horrify Chayefsky. But I think he'd also be pretty horrified by, say, the internet or even something like Twitter, where a bunch of us can just go to our electronic windows and shout out whatever we want and just, you know, create our own little electronic cacophonies in the same way that Howard Beale did.
You talked to a number of journalists and media personalities about Network, including, speaking of Fox News, Bill O'Reilly. What did he make of Network and what it meant today?
Well, you know, I think, understandably, he is reluctant to identify himself with Howard Beale or cite Beale as an inspiration. But, you know, I thought he had a very astute assessment of the movie, that, you know, he also read it as a kind of indictment, not only on news and broadcasters, but on audiences mm-hmm. and on people who aren't so, you know, careful about what they watch. And I think that there is a lot of truth there. Certainly, if you watch the movie, you look at, you know, what the sort of circus that the Howard Beale show turns into at the very end, and that has as much to do with that studio audience that's in attendance and just kind of, you know, miming whatever Howard Beale tells them to do. And I think that's you know, for O'Reilly to sort of connect those dots, I thought that was very perceptive of him.
And then there's Glenn Beck, who has compared himself to Howard Beale.
That's right. he has cited Howard Beale as an inspiration. And, you know, Stephen Colbert, in this book, he points out, you know, he says that, you know, Beck has cited the inspiration of people like, you know, Jesus and Gandhi and Howard Beale. And he adds, well, you know, none of those stories end well.
You know, going back, one of our earlier callers said it's still a good movie to watch. Is it? Is it still a fun movie to watch? It's been forever. Would it has some of it dated? Is it not aged well?
I know. You know. I mean, of course, I'm biased here because I wrote a book on the subject. But I'm happy to say, I mean, we've had a few screenings of the movie, you know, in conjunction with different events that I've done, and it seems like it's playing, you know, just as well as it would have in 1976. People are laughing at all, you know, all the lines that Paddy Chayefsky meant for them to find funny. But I think there's also a kind of a gallows humor that accompanies it now. That there are parts of the movie that we watch and we realize, well, this is just, you know, standard operating procedure for television now, and there's a kind of a dark humor in that we see. We're seeing a message that wasn't heeded, and you know, now we're living with the results of that.
We'll leave it there. Dave, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
That was Dave Itzkoff, culture reporter for the New York Times and author of the book Mad as Hell, The Making of Network and the Fateful Vision of the Angriest Man in Movies. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back with me on Monday. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.